private insurance, especially offices participating in various demonstration programs aimed at improving quality. There can easily be over 100 different measures to verify what office personnel are doing. And only a few of these measures having anything to do with the actual outcome of the visit, little to do with whether the patient was any better off having come in for the appointment. Lost in all of this, for the patient and the provider, is a simple notion that a patient should be able to go to the doctor when needed, and that the doctor should be able to provide the best quality care he or she can. A visit to the doctor's office should not be a bureaucratic nightmare. It should not be about filling out forms. It should not be a struggle with the insurance company to get it to cover a particular procedure. And doctor-patient relationship should be about the needs of the patient, not the profits of the insurance company. The irrationality of the current system can thus be seen not just in the profit margins and outrageously high compensation packages of CEOs in the insurance and pharmaceutical industries, but more significantly, in the huge amount of waste and inefficiencies inherent in an enormously complicated system designed to maximize profit rather than provide high quality and cost-effective healthcare. The United States has thousands of different health insurance plans, all of which set different reimbursement rates across different networks for providers and procedures. This results in extremely high administrative costs. According to a recent report drafted by 39 physicians from the Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP, and endorsed by some 2,500 medical doctors, a movement to a single-payer system would trim administration, reduce incentives to overtreat, lower drug prices, minimize wasteful investments in redundant facilities, and eliminate almost all marketing and investor profits. These measures would yield the substantial savings needed to fund universal care and new investments in currently underfunded services and public health activities, without any net increase in our national health spending. In other words, eliminating the hundreds of billions of dollars in wasteful and unnecessary administrative costs we now spend would free up all the funds we need to provide health care to every American. We don't need to spend more money on health care. We just need to spend our health care dollars more efficiently. According to the PNHP, private insurers' overhead currently averages 12% as compared with only 2.1% for fee-for-service Medicare. The complexity of the reimbursement systems also forces physicians and hospitals to waste substantial resources on documentation, billing, and collections. As a result, U.S. healthcare administration costs are about double those in Canada, where the single-payer system pays hospitals global budget and positions via simplified fee schedules. Reducing U.S. administrative costs to Canadian levels would save over $400 billion annually. Our dysfunctional healthcare system impacts not only patients and medical professionals, but our entire economy. Given that employer-based healthcare is the way most Americans get their coverage, small and medium-sized businesses are forced to spend an enormous amount of time and energy determining how they can get the most effective coverage for their employees. It's not uncommon for employers to spend weeks every year negotiating with insurance companies and switching carriers every year or two to get the best deal they can. When we talk about our current healthcare system, what is often overlooked is the negative impact it has on our entrepreneurial spirit. Millions of Americans remain on their job today not because they want to be there, not because they enjoy their work, but because their present employer provides decent healthcare benefits for them and their family. Think about the extraordinary impact it would have on our economy if every American had the freedom to follow his or her dreams and not have to worry about whether the family had health insurance. Universal health care would provide a major boon to our economy, unleashing the entrepreneurial spirit of millions of people. A for-profit health care system distorts medical priorities. Its main priority is to make as much money as possible, not necessarily to protect human health. The result is that we spend too much on high-tech procedures, which are very profitable, and too little on disease prevention. We spend more than we should on unnecessary surgeries and too little on primary care and social work. We spend more money per capita than any other country on prescription drugs, too little on nutrition education. As an example of the complete irrationality of the current system, I've talked to hospital administrators who describe how public and private insurance companies will spend tens of thousands of dollars on major surgery for a low-income person, but provide no coverage to make certain that when that person leaves the hospital and returns home, there's enough food for them to eat or the apartment is warm enough. Surprise, surprise! Some of those people, especially seniors, return to the hospital within a few days. If we weren't so accustomed to it, the waste and misplaced priorities of the current system would shock every American to the core. Despite the fact that we spend far, far more per capita on healthcare than any other country, we have fewer practicing physicians than the median Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, country. Because of the cost, we also hesitate to visit the doctor's office when we should. In fact, the average Canadian goes to the physician almost twice as often as we do. Medical procedures are very profitable. It should not be surprising, therefore, that the United States spends far more for medical procedures than any other country. According to a study by the International Federation of Health Plans, the average price of bypass surgery is $73,345 in the U.S. This is more than $30,000 higher than in the next highest spending country, Australia. While healthcare costs soar, and millions of Americans are unable to afford health insurance or prescription drugs, the healthcare industry reaps huge profits and pays its CEOs outrageously high compensation packages. In 2015, Leonard Schleifer, CEO of Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, made $47 million. Jeffrey M. Leiden, CEO of Vertex Pharmaceuticals, $28 million. Alex Gorsky, CEO of Johnson & Johnson, $21 million. Alan B. Miller, CEO of Universal Health Services, $20 million. Kenneth C. Frazier, CEO of Merck, nearly $20 million. David Cordani, CEO of Cigna, $17.3 million. And Mark T. Bertolini, CEO of Aetna, over $17.2 million. Yes, the priorities of our current system dictate that we have more than enough money to pay out fat executive salaries in the healthcare industry. We just don't have enough money to make sure that the working people can get the healthcare they need. Prescription drugs. When we talk about the high cost of healthcare in the United States and the inability of so many people to secure the care they need, we cannot ignore the crisis of the outrageously high cost of prescription drugs. In America, people get much sicker than they should and sometimes die because they cannot afford the medicine they need. Sometimes, in order to pay for their medicine, they end up lacking the money they need to provide for other basic needs. Today in the United States, we pay by far the highest price in the world for prescription drugs. A 2010 study showed that the United States paid on average double what Canada, Australia, and United Kingdom do. A 2013 report from the International Federation of Health Plans listed the comparative cost of the same drug sold in different countries. Here are a few examples of the different prices charged for widely used drugs in the U.S. and Canada. In some instances, drug prices are cheaper in other countries than they are in Canada. In Canada, Enbrel sold for $1,646, while in the U.S. it sold for $3,000. In Canada, Celebrex sold for $51, while in the U.S. it sold for $330. In Canada, Copaxone sold for $1,400, while in the U.S. it sold for $3,900. In Canada, Nexium sold for $30, while in the U.S. it sold for $305, and on it goes. While the five largest drug companies made a combined $50 billion in profits last year, one out of five Americans between the ages of 19 and 64 were unable to fill the prescriptions their doctors wrote. In other words, people go to the doctor because they're sick. They get a diagnosis from their doctor, but they can't afford the treatment. Then they get sicker. Does that make any sense to anyone? One of the reasons the pharmaceutical industry makes huge profits is pretty simple. Unlike every other major country on Earth, all of which negotiate prices with the pharmaceutical industry, here, in the U.S., drug companies can charge any price they want. And so they do. You can walk into your pharmacy tomorrow to get a refill of the same medicine that you've used for 20 years, and the price could be double what it was when you got your last refill 6 months before, and there's not a thing you can do about it. The best-known example of this rapaciousness of drug companies is a corporate profit machine called Valeant. In June 2015, Valeant raised the price of Glumetza, its diabetes drug, to $3,432 from $572. About a month later, Valeant hiked Glumetza's price again to $5,148. Later in 2015, Valeant raised the price of its acid reflux drug Zegrid from $421 to $3,034. Valeant increased the price of Cupramine, a treatment for Wilson's disease, from $6,547 to $26,189. When I was chairman of the Senate Committee of Veterans Affairs, I encountered a major example of a drug company ripoff. The VA, the largest integrated healthcare system in the country, spends billions on prescription drugs. It also has many patients who suffer from hepatitis C, a very serious disease. Several years ago, a new hepatitis C drug, Sovaldi, was created. This medication was developed with federal funding by a company named Pharmacet. In fact, one of the drug's developers was actually employed by the VA. After successfully developing Sovaldi, Pharmacet was purchased by Gilead Sciences, a large drug company. Upon purchasing Pharmacet, Gilead brought Sovaldi to market for the unbelievable cost of $84,000 for a 12-week course of treatment, or $1,000 per pill. The outrageous price means that, through the VA, the taxpayer of this country are subsidizing huge profits for Gilead Sciences in order to treat the men and women who have put their lives on the line to defend our country. It also means that in the private world, thousands of people with hepatitis C, many of whom have suffered for years, won't be able to get a medication that could cure them in a short period of time. They suffer. A drug company makes huge profits. Do you want to know why we pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs, and why there are no regulations preventing the drug companies from selling their products for any price they want? It might have something to do with the fact that the pharmaceutical industry is one of the most politically powerful industries in the country and spends endless amounts of money on lobbying and campaign contributions. The pharmaceutical industry has spent more than $3 billion on lobbying since 1998. This is $1 billion more than the insurance industry, which came in second place in lobbying expenditures. The pharmaceutical industry, because of its great power, rarely loses legislative fights. It has effectively purchased the Congress, and there are Republican and Democratic leaders who support its every effort. However, in July 1999, while I was in the House, I did set the industry back a bit when I put together what turned out to be the very first bus trip over the Canadian border to buy lower-cost prescription drugs. It is a day I will always cherish. We took a busload of Vermonters, mostly working-class women struggling with breast cancer, from St. Albans, Vermont to Montreal. I will never forget the look on the faces of those women who were fighting for their lives when they were able to buy the breast cancer medication tamoxifen at 10% what they were paying in Vermont. The result of that well-publicized trip and other trips taken by members of Congress or their constituents was that the American people caught on to the fact that prescription drugs were substantially less expensive in Canada. Today, in one way or another, millions of Americans purchase their prescription drugs from Canada and other countries where the cost is a fraction of what it is here. After that bus trip to Canada, I took to the floor of the House and asked a very simple question. How do you have a drug manufactured by a company, manufactured in the same factory, put in the same bottles, sold in Canada for one-tenth the price that the same medicine is sold for in the United States of America? How can that happen? The answer has everything to do with the power and greed of the pharmaceutical industry and a healthcare system more concerned about profits than about the needs of the American people. Dental care. When people talk about health care, they're usually referring to the medical care we receive when we go to a doctor for one or another problem with our body. But health care is more than that. Largely ignored is the reality that we have a major dental crisis in this country. Tens of millions of Americans are unable to afford the dental care they need. They suffer with painful toothaches. They get teeth extracted because it's cheaper than getting the tooth properly treated, a plight I suffered when I was a young man. Without good teeth, people are unable to properly digest the food they eat, which can lead to other medical problems. Bad teeth can not only lead to pain and illness, but it has an economic consequence. Try applying for a job when your front teeth are missing and you can't smile. Having bad or missing teeth makes it clear to the world that you are poor, which makes it harder for you to find employment, which perpetuates the cycle of poverty. And for kids, toothaches are one of the major causes of school absenteeism. Once a year in Southern Virginia, doctors, dentists, and other medical personnel donate a few days of their time to treat the uninsured and underinsured. People without insurance sleep in their cars the nights before the medical personnel arrive in order to make sure they get treated. The field where the doctors and dentists set up their temporary facilities looks like a third world country with poor people in pain spread throughout waiting to get medical or dental care. In Vermont, community health centers are a major provider of dental care for low and moderate income people. One of the more creative innovations in dental care in recent years, these centers bring dentists and dental practitioners right into schools throughout the state. In Burlington, a modern dental office was established in a low-income school. This approach has been very effective in treating kids throughout Burlington and has been effective in several other areas of the state as well. Mental health. And then there's the extraordinary crisis that we face in terms of mental health care. As I traveled the country, it became clear to me that people were deeply concerned about this issue. Whenever I talked about the need for revolution in mental health treatment, it would get a strong response. People often knew someone, maybe themselves, struggling with drug addiction or a serious mental disorder and unable to find help. The crisis in mental health impacts every area of our lives. In my Senate office, and I suspect in every Senate office, the calls come in, I'm worried about my brother, what he might do to himself or someone else, but we can't find the mental health treatment he needs at a cost that we can afford. In our country today, there are thousands of people walking the streets, many of them owning guns, who are suicidal and or homicidal, and we're doing virtually nothing to address this crisis. Further, in schools throughout this country, teachers are finding themselves increasingly overwhelmed with special needs kids who are disrupting their classes, and there's often very little help available for them. There's a massive shortage of pediatric psychiatrists and psychologists. Every police chief in the country will tell you about the connection between mental illness, addiction, and crime. Thousands of mentally unstable people cannot stay on a job or earn a steady income. Many of them alienated from their families. In order to survive, some of them will steal. People who are addicted to opiates or heroin need to feed their habits. They will commit crimes to get the drugs they require. Instead of providing the care and treatment these people need, we're putting them in jails. This does nothing to address the underlying causes of their problems and ends up wasting billions of taxpayer dollars. According to an excellent special report in USA Today, more than 500,000 Americans with serious mental illnesses are falling through the cracks of a system in tatters. The mentally ill, who have nowhere to go and find little sympathy from those around them, often land hard in emergency rooms, county jails, and city streets. The lucky ones find homes with family. The unlucky ones show up in the morgue. States looking to save money have pared away both the community mental health services designed to keep people healthy, as well as the hospital care needed to help them heal after a crisis. States have been reducing hospital beds for decades because of insurance pressures, as well as a desire to provide more care outside institutions. Tight budgets during the recession forced some of the most devastating cuts in recent memory, says Robert Glover, executive director of the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors. States cut $5 billion in mental health services from 2009 to 2012. In the same period, the country eliminated at least 4,500 public psychiatric hospital beds, nearly 10% of the total supply, he says. The result is that, all too often, people with mental illness get no care at all. Nearly 40% of adults with severe mental illness, such as schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, received no treatment in the previous year, according to the 2012 National Survey on Drug Use and Health. Among adults with any mental illness, 60% were untreated. In the year 2016, the time is long overdue for us to understand that a mental health problem should be treated like any other health-related issue. People must be able to get the mental health treatment they need, when they need it, not 6 months from now, or even worse, maybe never. In America today, we need a revolution in mental health treatment. Healthcare outcome. One might reasonably think that given the fact that we spend far more per capita on healthcare than any other country on earth, our healthcare outcomes would be as good as or better than other countries. Surely, with all the money we spend, we must be living longer and healthier lives. Our infant mortality rates must be lower than they are in other countries, and our people must be suffering fewer illnesses. Well, that might be a reasonable thought, but it's wrong. Dead wrong. Let me quote from a press release from the Commonwealth Fund, a private foundation that studies international healthcare systems, describing the results of a major 2014 study it did on healthcare systems around the world. Despite having the most expensive healthcare system, the United States ranks last overall among 11 industrialized countries on measures of health system quality, efficiency, access to care, equity, and healthy lives, according to a new Commonwealth Fund report. The other countries included in the study were Australia, Canada, France, Germany, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Sweden, Switzerland, and the United Kingdom. While there is room for improvement in every country, the U.S. stands out for having the highest costs and lowest performance. The U.S. spent $8,508 per person on healthcare in 2011, compared with $3,406 in the United Kingdom, which ranked first overall. That report indicated that the U.S. had the lowest life expectancy at birth of the country studied and the highest infant mortality rate. The prevalence of chronic disease also appeared to be higher in the U.S. The study found that 68% of U.S. adults aged 65 or older had at least two chronic conditions. In other countries, this figure ranged from 33% in the United Kingdom to 56% in Canada. A healthy society creates good health. Let me conclude this chapter by stating that we must create a high-quality, universal healthcare system guaranteeing healthcare for every man, woman, and child. But we must do even more than that. We must create a healthy society. Most people understand that being in good health physically and emotionally is more than just a function of the care you receive, no matter how high quality that care may be. If you are poor and struggling every day with the stress of putting food on the table and a roof over your head, your health suffers. Several years ago, I chaired a Senate hearing entitled Poverty as a Death Sentence, and the title is absolutely correct. The life expectancy for poor people is much lower than it is for wealthy people, and there are parts of the country now where Americans are actually dying at a younger age than their parents did. This is often the result of economic despair and an increase in drug addiction, alcoholism, and suicide. If you go to work every day hating your job, there's no question that your frustration and anger will impact your health. People cannot spend 40 or 50 hours a week doing something that they dislike without suffering serious health consequences. People cannot fight their way through traffic jams every day or experience delays in crowded airports without paying a health-related price. If you're a senior citizen living alone and isolated, as many are, your health will suffer. Too many seniors in our country suffer from depression and alcohol-related problems. Friends, family, and community help us stay healthy. If you are a child breathing filthy air from a coal-burning plant or some other source of pollution, your health will suffer. In low-income communities throughout the country, children suffer from high rates of asthma and other preventable diseases. Clean air, clean water, and decent food are necessary if we are to stay healthy. The bottom line is that everything is connected to everything. Our political task is nothing less than the transformation of our nation. Healthcare for all, absolutely. But in order to create a healthy society, we also need to end poverty and provide decent-paying jobs for all people. We need a strong educational system, a clean environment, and equal opportunity for everyone regardless of their race, gender, sexual orientation, or nationality. These, in fact, are all health-related issues. The choice is now. At a time when tens of millions of Americans are uninsured or underinsured, when we have major crises in primary health care, the cost of prescription drugs, dental care, and mental health care treatment, this country has got to make two very fundamental decisions. First, do we join the rest of the industrialized world and guarantee comprehensive health care to all people as a right, or do we stay with the current dysfunctional system that we have? Second, if we choose to move toward universal health care, what is the best and most cost-effective approach? To me, the answer is pretty simple. From both a moral and economic perspective, the United States must guarantee health care for every man, woman, and child as a right. And the best way to do that is through a Medicare for All single-payer system. Here is an outline of that single-payer plan I introduced during my presidential campaign. Medicare for All, leaving no one behind. Coverage. A federally administered single-payer healthcare program means comprehensive coverage for all Americans. This plan will cover the entire continuum of healthcare, from inpatient to outpatient care, preventive to emergency care, primary to specialty care, including long-term and palliative care, vision, hearing, and oral healthcare, mental health care and substance abuse services, as well as prescription medications, medical equipment, supplies, diagnostics, and treatments. Patients will be able to choose a health care provider without worrying about whether that provider is in network and will be able to get the care they need without having to read any fine print or trying to figure out how they can afford the out-of-pocket costs. What it means for patients. As a patient, all you need to do is go to the doctor and show your insurance card. A single-payer plan means no more copays, no more deductibles, and no more fighting with insurance companies when they fail to pay for charges. Getting healthcare spending under control. We outspend all other countries on our healthcare, and our medical spending continues to grow faster than the rate of inflation. Creating a single public insurance system will go a long way toward getting healthcare spending under control. The United States has thousands of different healthcare insurance plans, all of which set different reimbursement rates across different networks for providers and procedures. This results in an enormous amount of paperwork and high administrative costs. Two patients with the same condition may get very different care depending on where they live, the health insurance they have, and what their insurance covers. A patient may pay different amounts for the same prescription drug depending solely on where the prescription is filled. Healthcare providers and patients must navigate this complex and bewildering system, wasting precious time and resources. By moving to an integrated system, the government will finally have the ability to stand up to drug companies and negotiate fair prices for the American people collectively. The government will also be able to track access to various providers and make smart investments to avoid provider shortages and ensure that communities have the providers they need. Major savings for families and businesses. The United States currently spends $3.2 trillion on health care each year, about $10,000 per person. Reforming our system, simplifying our payment structure, and incentivizing new ways to make sure patients are actually getting better care will generate massive savings. This plan has been estimated to save the American people and businesses more than $6 trillion over the next decade. The typical middle-class family would save over $5,000 under this plan. Last year, the average working family paid $4,955 in premiums and $1,318 in deductibles to private health insurance companies. Under this plan, a family of four earning $50,000 would pay just $466 per year to the single-payer program, amounting to a savings of over $5,800 for that family each year. Businesses would save over $9,400 a year in healthcare costs for the average employee. The average annual cost to the employer for a worker with a family who makes $50,000 a year would go from $12,591 to just $3,100. How much will it cost? This plan has been estimated to cost $1.38 trillion per year. How would it be paid for? A 6.2% income-based health care premium paid by employers, revenue raised $630 billion per year. A 2.2% income-based premium paid by households, revenues raised $210 billion per year. A family of four taking the standard deduction can have income up to $28,800 and not pay this tax. Progressive income tax rates. Revenue raised $110 billion a year. Under this plan, the marginal income tax rate would be 37% on incomes between $250,000 and $500,000. 43% on incomes between $500,000 and $2 million. 48% on income between $2 million and $10 million. In 2013, only 113,000 households, the top 0.08% of taxpayers, had income between $2 million and $10 million. 52% on income above $10 million. In 2013, only 13,000 households, just 0.01% of taxpayers, had income exceeding $10 million. Taxing capital gains and dividends the same as income from work. Revenues raised $92 billion per year. Warren Buffett, the second wealthiest person in the country, has said that he pays a lower effective tax rate than his secretary. The reason is that he receives most of his income from capital gains and dividends, which are taxed at a much lower rate than income from work. This plan will end the special tax breaks for capital gains and dividends on household income above $250,000. Limit tax deductions for the rich. Revenue raised $15 billion per year. Under this plan, households making over $250,000 would no longer be able to save more than 28 cents in taxes from every dollar in tax deductions. This limit would replace more complicated and less effective limits on tax breaks for the rich, including the alternative minimum tax, the personal exemption phase-out, and the limit on itemized deductions. The responsible estate tax revenue raised $21 billion per year. This provision would tax the estates of the wealthiest 0.3%, 0.3% of Americans who inherit over $3.5 million at progressive rates and would close loopholes in estate tax. Savings from health tax expenditures. Revenue raised $310 billion per year. Several tax breaks that subsidize health care, health-related tax expenditures would become obsolete and disappear under a single-payer health care system, saving $310 billion per year. Most important, health care provided by employers is compensation that is not subject to payroll taxes or income taxes under current law. This is a significant tax break that would effectively disappear under this plan because all Americans would receive health care through the new single-payer rather than their employer-based program. 5. Making higher education affordable. In the 21st century, a public education system that goes from kindergarten through high school is no longer good enough. The world is changing, technology is changing, our economy is changing. If we are to succeed in the highly competitive global economy and have the best educated workforce in the world, public college and universities must become tuition-free. In May 2014, a year before I began my campaign for president, I held a press conference in my Burlington state office to discuss the crisis of college affordability and student debt. I invited a group of university students who were graduating that month to join me, and many arrived wearing simple white placards hanging from their necks showing the amount of student debt they had. One sign had a precise number, $24,547. Another read $30,000. Another $40,000. A young physician who had recently graduated medical school had a debt of $300,000. What struck me was that these were all bright young adults who should have been looking forward to building independent lives and careers. But instead, they were weighed down by the reality that they were deeply in debt before they'd even completed their first job application. Graduation should mark a joyous new beginning, not the start of an anxiety-ridden, decades-long financial bind. One of the truly remarkable aspects of the campaign that I would launch a year later, and quite frankly, one that took me by surprise, was how much the campaign resonated with young people. In state after state, they joined our campaign in droves. They were motivated by a sense of youthful optimism, but they were also deeply concerned about the state of our country and world. Some were alarmed by climate change, others were worried about the availability of jobs and the stagnant economy. In communities of color, many were outraged that the very people entrusted to protect them were instead targeting and harassing them. Some were worried they could be sent off to fight yet in another ill-conceived war in the Middle East, or be deported even though this was the only country they had ever known. But the issue that was so often uppermost in the minds of the countless young people I met all across the country was the ever-escalating cost of college and the scourge of student debt. Whether they were thinking about attending college, were currently enrolled, or had already graduated, they were deeply worried that they would be saddled with an unsurmountable amount of debt for years to come. Unfortunately, they were right to worry. The high cost of college and student debt impacts not only those who are in college and in their families, but low-income and working-class families who are simply not able to send their kids to college. Today in America, hundreds of thousands of bright young people who have the desire and the ability to get a college education will not be able to do so because their families lack the money. This is a tragedy for those young people and their families, but it is also a tragedy for our nation. How many scientists, engineers, business people, teachers, doctors, and nurses are we losing because higher education in this country is unaffordable for so many? This year, nearly 70% of all students graduating with a bachelor's degree will leave school with some debt, with the average amount exceeding $35,000. 1 in 8 graduates will graduate with more than $50,000 in outstanding student loans. And that's not including the mountains of credit card debt that some students incur trying to make ends meet while in school. Obviously, for those going to medical school, dental school, nursing school, or graduate school in general, the debt is much higher. Unlike other types of personal debt that have been decreasing in recent years, student debt has been steadily increasing. In all, 43.3 million people, current students, graduates, and those who left college before graduating, now owe more than $1.3 trillion in student loans. This is more than triple the amount of student debt in 2004, and more than all credit card and auto loan debt in the United States combined. And an increasing portion of those 43.3 million people will carry their student debt their entire lives. According to the Government Accountability Office, Americans nearing retirement have the fastest growing student loan debt of any age group, having soared from $2.8 billion in 2005 to $18.2 billion in 2013. I remember well a gentleman I met during a town meeting in Nevada. 55 years of age, he told us that he had been paying off his student loan for 25 years, but was in more debt today than when he first took out the loan. He's worried now that his Social Security checks will be garnished in order to pay off that debt. How crazy is that? In my view, it is profoundly wrong that so many talented, hard-working young people are starting their lives under such a crushing mountain of debt, debt that will weigh them down and hold them back for much or even most of their lives. And it is profoundly unfair that other students, simply because they had the good fortune to be born into wealthy families, can graduate college without a cent of debt. If we are a country that truly believes in equal opportunity, shouldn't we level the playing field for all young Americans? I certainly think so. Here's a simple question. Instead of encouraging young people to get a higher education, why are we punishing them for doing so? Why are we making it so hard? That seems pretty crazy to me. It is crazy not just for the individuals impacted, but for the future of our economy and our economic competitiveness. The United States used to lead the world in the percentage of people who graduated college, which is one of the reasons that we've had the strongest economy in the world. Today, that is no longer the case. In 2011, CNN reported, "The U.S. once led the world in college graduates. As an example of this, Americans aged 55 to 64 still lead their peers in other nations in the portion with college degrees, 41%. But this number is flatlined for Americans. In 2008, the same percentage of Americans aged 25 and 34 and aged 55 to 64 were college graduates. Meanwhile, other nations have caught up, and some have pulled ahead. Among this younger age group from 25 to 34, all of the following nations now have a larger percent of college graduates than the U.S. Australia, Belgium, Canada, Denmark, France, Ireland, Israel, Japan, South Korea, Luxembourg, New Zealand, Norway, Sweden, and the United Kingdom." An Education Week wrote about a recent report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development that shows, "Since 1995, higher education in the United States has become increasingly more expensive. The nation's college graduation rate has not grown at the same speed, and as that slowed, other countries have caught up and even surpassed the United States in their supply of college students." Frankly, this is very frightening. We used to lead the world in terms of the percentage of all people who are college graduates, but now among the younger generation, we are in 15th place and falling further and further behind. Does anyone not believe that this will have severe economic consequences for the future of our economy and our way of life? This is why I ran for president on a program of making public colleges and universities tuition free. I believe that higher education in America should be a right for all, not a privilege for the few. That means that everyone, regardless of their station in life, should be able to get all of the education they need. This is a revolutionary and transformative concept that goes well beyond the impact it will have on higher education. All across the country today, there are low-income children in the fourth or fifth grade who already understand instinctively that they're never going to make it into the middle class. Their parents are poor, they are poor, and they will be poor in the future. And that's the way it is. They and their parents live in communities where very few people go to college. Hanging around with college-educated families is not their world. For those children, the idea of getting a college education and making it into the middle class is as likely as going to the moon, and many of those kids at a very early age give up on school and learning. They may not officially drop out of school until they are 16, but they intellectually drop out at much younger ages. Our mission must be to give hope to those young people. If every parent in this country, every teacher in this country, and every student in this country understands that if kids study hard and do well in school, they will be able to go to college regardless of the income of their family, that will have a radical impact on primary and secondary education in the United States and on the lives of millions of families. That's what we can accomplish by making colleges and universities tuition-free and making certain that every American, no matter his or her economic status, has the opportunity for a higher education. Education has always been, perhaps more than any other institution in our society, the great equalizer. Education, especially in a rapidly evolving economy, is how people qualify for better jobs and do well at them. It is the key to solving many of the serious problems of economic, racial, and gender inequality plaguing our society. But as college becomes less affordable, and as working families take on increasing amounts of debt, higher education may actually be increasing social and economic inequality rather than alleviating it. Making higher education universally available will not only create a better educated society, it will allow us to be a more just society. In 1877, Rutherford B. Hayes was the first president to make a strong case for universally available public education. Universal suffrage should rest upon universal education, he said in his inaugural address, adding, liberal and permanent provision should be made for the support of free schools. For Hayes, a Republican, education was the basis for full economic and political participation and the basis for prosperity. I agree. There used to be a time, 40 or 50 years ago, when many people could graduate from high school and move right into a decent paying job with good benefits. Strong unions offered apprenticeships, and a large manufacturing sector provided opportunities for those without an advanced degree. A couple with the sole breadwinner could buy a home, raise a family, and send their kids to college. That was the American dream. Those days are pretty much over. With the loss of some 60,000 factories in the last 15 years and the decline of the trade union movement, it is harder and harder for workers to make it into the middle class. Today, perhaps the most important pathway to the middle class runs through higher education. While not all middle class jobs in today's economy require a college degree, an increasing number do. People need a higher education to make it into the middle class and successfully compete in a global economy. But the fact of the matter is that rising costs are making it harder and harder for ordinary Americans to get the college education they want. Since 1970, average inflation-adjusted tuition at a four-year public university has almost quadrupled. In the last 10 years, tuition has increased by almost 60%. Meanwhile, in the midst of this crisis, government has been doing exactly the wrong thing. While the cost of attending college is going up, per-student public funding for higher education has been going down. While this has been going on for decades, the Great Recession accelerated this trend. As state governments around the country began the process of making draconian cuts to funding for public colleges, for many governors whose campaign contributions came from the wealthy and large corporations, giving tax breaks to the rich was a higher priority than enabling working-class students to get a college education. In 1980, state governments contributed close to 80% of the cost of instruction. Today, it is less than half. What exactly does this mean for the more than three-quarters of college students in the United States who attend public colleges? It means that students and their parents, even though wages have been stagnant for decades, must bear a higher percentage of the soaring costs of a college degree. The cost of a public college education accounted for 4% of the average family's annual income 40 years ago. Today, it is 15%. In 1978, it was possible to earn enough money to pay for a year of college tuition just by working a full-time summer job that paid minimum wage. Today, it would take a minimum wage worker an entire year to earn enough to cover the average annual in-state tuition at a public university, if that worker had no other expenses at all that year. But we all know that a person cannot live on, much less save any money, on a minimum wage job. It's no wonder many students from low-income families are forced to work while attending college, sometimes holding down more than one job, in addition to attending classes, studying, and working unpaid internships. Try working the late shift at McDonald's while you're preparing for finals. Not easy. I've talked to too many students who are trying hard to focus on their education while working 30 to 40 hours a week. Some students concoct elaborate cost-saving schemes, taking courses at less expensive schools and transferring credits, only to find that not all schools will accept the credits. And as we've seen, most take on unsustainable amounts of debt. Why do we put them through this? Why are we making it so difficult for these students to succeed? Well, it is my view that all students in this country, regardless of income, have the right to get a higher education if they have the ability and desire. It is important to take a hard look at why the cost of college is rising so rapidly. And it is also important to point out that the reason the cost of higher education is rising is not that colleges are spending any more per student. Other factors are driving the steep cost curve. One of them is the increasing cost of health insurance for staff and faculty. The fact that we have the most expensive healthcare system in the world significantly impacts college costs, just as it does any large business. Another major cost driver is the proliferation of administrative positions in higher education. Just between 1993 and 2009, administrative positions grew by more than 60%, more than 10 times the growth rate of tenured professors, and at many times the salary. As colleges and universities become more corporatized and bureaucratic, colleges need more bureaucrats to run them. Exactly how much do students benefit by having, in some cases, dozens of vice presidents of this or that, each earning hundreds of thousands of dollars or more? Not very much. Another reason college educations are becoming so expensive is that colleges are increasingly being run as businesses competing for market share. To become more attractive to prospective students, they spend huge amounts of money on fancy student centers and dorms, state-of-the-art gyms and sports stadiums, and countless other campus amenities. While this trend is certainly more exaggerated at private schools, public colleges and universities are not immune to big spending on bells and whistles that drive up tuition while providing little or no academic benefit to the students. Now, I know that I'm a bit old-fashioned, but I still believe that the function of a college or university is to provide the best quality education possible, and I suspect students can survive without fancy dormitory suites, gourmet food, and football coaches who make $5 million a year. Further, the cost of college textbooks has risen tenfold since 1977. The average full-time university student in the United States now pays more than $1,200 each year just for books and supplies. This exorbitant increase is driven by stranglehold contracts with book publishers that restrict digital access to their products and that release newer and more expensive editions every few years that prevent students from using less expensive used books. Let's call it what it is, a racket. My Senate colleague, Richard Durbin of Illinois, introduced a bill to move toward open-source digital content as an alternative to traditional textbooks. I think that makes a lot of sense, but unfortunately, the bill has not even been given a hearing in Congress. The high cost of college isn't just bad for students and their families, it's bad for our economy too. While a college education will eventually pay off for many people, the large amount of debt incurred for that education has a real and immediate impact on the standard of living of millions and on our national economy. Growing student debt is one of the major reasons young people are delaying getting married and having kids, and why families are putting off buying homes, starting businesses, and saving for retirement. This, in turn, is slowing overall economic growth. And less growth means fewer jobs and less tax revenue to pay for the services Americans want and deserve. Further, ballooning student debt is introducing an element of risk into our financial system that is eerily reminiscent of the house mortgage crisis. Some financial analysts even believe that student loan debt could be the next debt bubble to burst, as the total amount of outstanding debt grows at an alarming rate while more and more students lack the income to repay their loans. Already, more than 1 in 4 student loan borrowers is delinquent or in default, and more than 40% of those who borrowed from the government's main loan program are either in default or in delinquency on more than $200 billion they owe the government. If the $1.3 trillion in debt owed collectively by 43 million Americans goes bad for whatever reason, it would put an extreme strain on our financial system and could even precipitate another crisis. You would think, for the sake of the overall economy at least, if not for the students themselves, that government policy would allow people to get out from under unsustainable student debt by refinancing at lower interest rates. You would think that the Americans carrying student debt would be able to refinance that debt like they can with their home mortgages, right? Wrong. Incredibly, most student debt in this country cannot be refinanced, even if the loan was originally made at very high interest rates. Further, unlike other forms of debt, student loans are very difficult to discharge, even in bankruptcy. In fact, it is much easier for a big bank or corporation to declare insolvency and be forgiven for outstanding debts than it is for an individual going through personal bankruptcy to discharge a student loan. So what happens if a borrower can't pay a student loan? Some borrowers have had their tax refunds withheld, and some seniors have had their Social Security benefits garnished. Some student loans end up with aggressive collection agencies who hound borrowers to the point of harassment, and some borrowers have even been arrested. In Texas, where tuition increases led to higher rates of borrowing and with it more defaults, marshals have arrested people for not paying student loans. America rightfully outlawed debtors' prisons in the mid-19th century. But some cities and states are issuing contempt of court warrants that get around those rules. Education and learning is an inherent part of what being a human being is all about. In my view, we should be creating opportunities for Americans to continue learning, formally and informally, until the day they die. Further, at a time of exploding technology and a rapidly changing economy, the United States needs a well-educated population if we are to compete effectively in the global economy. I have already heard from many employers who tell me that they are unable to find the high-skilled employees they need for the good-paying new jobs being created. The United States should not be falling behind other countries in terms of making public colleges and universities accessible to all, regardless of income. We should be leading the way. We should be understanding that investing in our young people's education is not only the right thing to do for them, it's the right thing to do for the future of our economy and our country. Making public colleges and universities tuition-free. During the presidential campaign, I outlined a simple and straightforward proposal that would make public colleges and universities tuition-free. This plan, the College for All Act, would allow all Americans, if they had the ability and the desire, to go to college regardless of the income of their families. It would also prevent them from going deeply into debt as a result of their education. The College for All Act would create a partnership between the U.S. government and states that would provide $2 in federal funding for every dollar a state spends on making public colleges and universities tuition-free for undergraduate students. The plan would also cover 100% of the cost of books and room and board for low-income students. The College for All Act would more than triple the federal work-study program to build a valuable career experience that would help students after they graduate. And it would expand Pell Grants, which used to cover 3/4 of the cost of a college education for many low-income students, but now cover only 1/3 of it on average. The College for All Act would open the door to a middle-class life for millions of young Americans and make our economy stronger and more productive. Yes, it's that simple. Free college tuition is not a radical idea. In Finland, Denmark, Ireland, Iceland, Norway, Sweden, and Mexico, public colleges and universities are free. In Denmark, not only is a college tuition free, but people who go to college in that country actually get paid. In Germany, the public colleges are free not only for Germans, but also for international students, which is why every year more than 4,500 students from the United States enroll in German universities. For a token fee of about $200 per year, an American student can earn a degree in math or engineering from one of the premier universities in Europe. Governments in those countries understand the value of investing in their young people. They know that these students will acquire the knowledge and skills to strengthen their countries and become the teachers, architects, engineers, scientists, and entrepreneurs of the future. They realize that by allowing all qualified students, regardless of income, to achieve a higher education, they're making a down payment on their country's economic prosperity. It may seem hard to believe, but there was a time in the not-too-distant past when higher education was pretty close to being free in this country. In 1965, average tuition at a 4-year public university was just $243, and many of the best colleges, such as the City University of New York, CUNY, did not charge any tuition at all. Hundreds of thousands of students received a free education from CUNY, and many of them came from working-class backgrounds and were the first in their families to attend college.